Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of vanityfair.com, and I'm here to introduce this special holiday episode of the show with our film critic Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And our senior writer Joanna Robinson.
Hello.
So this week, it's the week of Christmas as you listen to this, and we're going to be sharing two interviews that Richard has done in recent weeks. Richard, I can't come up with a clever way to say how Leslie Manville and Jamie Bell are related, but you just met with both of them, so tell me what they have in common.
Well, I have a tradition every year. I like to, toward the end of the year, I'd like to sit down with British people and just talk to them. So that's
feel insecure about your education or your accent.
We put on those little paper Christmas crowns that you always see in British movies about Christmas. And we do little crackers and all that stuff. So that's what we did. Not in the same, at the same time, unfortunately. But yeah, we had Leslie Manville in to talk about Phantom Thread, which he's wonderful in. And Jamie Bell, who's terrific in Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool, which is a movie with Annette Bening that has been a little overlooked this season, but I think is definitely worth seeing and talking about, because as I spoke to Jamie about, like, it's kind of a breakthrough for him in terms of being a romantic lead, because it's different from a lot of stuff he's done before.
And this is a very like old Hollywood. I always imagine that our listeners are old Hollywood lovers, but Annette Bening is playing Gloria Graham. So it's got like a nice sort of old Hollywood history bent to it. It's a lovely film. I really liked it.
And so Leslie Manville is the star of Phantom Thread, the new Paul Thomas Anderson film. And I think anyone who saw her in Mike Leigh's Another Year has been kind of rooting for her to have like a big breakout film again. And this seems like it's the one to do it.
Yes, she's terrific in it. And, you know, I had most associated her with Another Year, where she plays this kind of like booze-addled mess. And she walked into the studio just dressed to the nines, looking fabulous, which is much more in keeping with her character in Phantom Thread. So that was interesting. And while we talked, I did bring up Another Year, and she had a really interesting kind of anecdote about filming that movie and a particular scene. So if anyone who knows that movie who's listening, you should stay tuned for that.
So we will be back next week with a full roundtable chat as usual. But in the meantime, please enjoy these interviews with Richard and Leslie Manville and Jamie Bell. So first up will be Richard's interview with Phantom Thread star Leslie Manville.
Well, I'm sitting across the table from the one and only Leslie Manville. Leslie, thank you for being here.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's such a thrill to have you here, not just because I've been a fan of your work for a long time, Another Year, various other things, but because Phantom Thread, the movie that you're in and here promoting, is such a special. It was my number 6 on my top 10 of the year list, although I should have just done it alphabetically, because who can really rank these things? It's just one of my favorite movies of the year. It's
good.
Really great.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah. Are you already basking in the reception of it? I mean, it's not even really out here in the States yet, but like, people have seen it, obviously.
Yes, well, there's been industry screenings,
right.
And we were at a screening for AMPAS members last night, which is the Academy. It's going down very, very, very well. I mean, you come out of the screening and people are saying very positive and very pleasing things. It feels that it's good, but it's quite early days for it still. I mean, it doesn't get released in the States till Christmas Day, and it doesn't get released in England till the 2nd of February. I mean, the film simply wasn't ready in time to do any of the festivals. We didn't stop shooting till April. So there was no way it could be turned around for Cannes or Toronto or anything. It was hot off the press, really, and we got on the plane and started promoting it. So yeah, we're off and away now.
I was at the screening that was the Sunday after Thanksgiving at the DGA Theater, and you guys were all there for the Q&A afterwards.
Oh yes,
and it just had this sense of occasion to it. You know, everyone was really eager to see this film. It was one of the last things that us critics and other people hadn't seen yet. You know,
so yes.
How do you bear up under all this those kind of like, you know, these AMPAS screenings and all this kind of press stuff. Like, is that fun for you, or is it stressful, or how does that?
No, I don't find it stressful. I don't think I could bow out of it easily, and I would if I found it stressful, but I don't. I really like the chance to talk about the work and talk about what we've been through, because when you're making a film, you're making it, and it is what it is, and you're so involved in it. So in a way, it feels like having a really good debrief. And, you know, the Q&As I've done have always been with Paul and Vicky, and some of them have been with Daniel as well. And it's good to hear what the people you've worked with it on, what they feel about it. And I quite enjoy working out what I've felt about it too, and yeah, having to put my thoughts and feelings into something, into a sentence that makes sense. Sure. And helps people to understand what we've made.
Because I guess those aren't conversations you're necessarily having while you're doing it, right?
No, but that's exactly it. You're not. You're kind of in the thick of it, and you're not. You're being analytical, but in a different way. You're being analytical, and you're digging deep because you're trying to create it. You know, you're creating those characters, and Paul is creating the film. Now we're, you know, it's done. We can't change it. I find it fascinating. I like traveling. It's good to be able to be in New York for 4 days and see some friends and have a little bit of spare time as well. So listen, it's not what I'd call hard work.
Well, let's go back. And I'm just curious to hear how you got involved with the project. I mean, Paul Thomas Anderson, he's such an American filmmaker. I mean, he makes these films about America, you know, There Will Be Blood and The Master. Although I guess parts of The Master are in England. So this is kind of a departure for him in a sense. And so I'm just curious, like, what were the conversations like when you were first kind of getting involved in this?
The very first conversation I had with him was incredibly straightforward. My agent rang me and said, Paul Thomas Anderson wants to ring you at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. I said, oh, tell him I'm going to be doing the laundry or something. Make him go away. So he did call at 11 on the dot, and he's one of the nicest men you could wish to meet. He's kind, he's warm. And so he said, look, I've got this film. It's going to be an English story with Daniel, and I'm going to send you a script, have a read, and give me a call back. So I did, and that was it. It was as simple as that.
And so you knew reading the script, you were like, I want to do this? Like, it was clear to you then?
Listen, he could have asked me to read the phone directory, and I would have done it. Yeah. So given that the script was actually really, really interesting and certainly ticked the box of the kind of film I'm interested in seeing and the kind of film I'm certainly interested in doing. You know, it's a relationship film. There's no car chases. It's about, you know, humans, the human condition.
They cut all the musical numbers after you'd filmed them, right?
cut my tap routine. But you know, it seemed almost too good to be true. I mean, I was smiling for a very long time, and this was about 6-7 months before we started shooting. So I had a nice long time to think about it and do the research and look into the fashion world in the 50s, which wasn't an area that was alien to me. I'd done a play that was all about the 50s, so I knew that period a bit. But it was fascinating, and I got to know Daniel over that time, and a few drafts would come, a few new drafts, but nothing major changed. It's been an incredible experience. And I mean, not just because, I mean, I'm incredibly lucky. I have a wonderful career in England. I do, you know, my theatre career couldn't be any better there. I do fabulous things on television, and I make films with interesting people, not least of all Mike Lee. The cherry on the cake has been to do this film, and not just because it's, you know, America. Paul he's a great director.
Yeah, he's one of the greats, I think, right now, you know.
And yeah, he happens to be American. Quite a treat to work with Daniel as well.
And not being British myself, but being friends with people from the UK and being visiting there, the film feels, it feels authentically true to what it's trying to do, you know, and which I think is important.
Yes.
You know, it's not some American coming over there and having you guys all saying cheerio. And
oh, no, no,
he's a little bit more subtle than that.
He certainly knows his stuff. Yeah.
Well, something that I love about your character in the film, you played Daniel Day-Lewis's sister slash business partner. I mean, she's not just this kind of ancillary sibling.
No.
She's very front and center. you have this presence in the movie that is not always verbal, but certainly physical. And, you know, we get a lot of cuts to your face just kind of reacting at these hilariously loud breakfasts, you know, and things like that. So how do you approach doing that where you might not have necessarily, you know, the sort of torrent of dialogue?
Yeah, no,
film,
I hear what you're saying. It's very hard to say, to pinpoint a moment, because I think it's a mistake to ladle things onto a performance just because you think it might be interesting. For me, and I think generally with acting and actors, that the best things that happen come out of some kind of quiet gestation about things, and they sort of almost happen by osmosis and organically. And then suddenly you find, oh yes, there's this, so she's like this. And in a way, that's how it happened. I mean, Paul doesn't rehearse at all. He wasn't prescriptive about how to play Cyril. The character's called Cyril, by the way. I had a freedom with it. So sort of having done all the research to do with everything else, the period and the couture side of things, we just started to do the scenes. I mean, we'd shoot and we had the luxury of time. And then Paul gets excited and he sees what you're doing and I was unsure of what to do. I thought, well, you know, I'm just going to start doing some stuff and see how it feels. And, you know, and then you just start playing around with it. But obviously, as you quite rightly say, it's not so much about what's written for Cyril. So I thought, well, I better make these looks quite interesting. But it's not kind of, right, I'm going to do interesting looks here. I mean, it comes out of the fact that she is very, her antennae are very, very acute. And she knows when a rubbing Reynolds up the wrong way. She knows when the toast is being buttered too noisily. She knows that because her and her brother are so in tune. They've grown up together. They've probably spent most days of their lives together. They're very codependent. They've established this amazing couture house in London together. And they run the business seamlessly. So there's something very exacting about the pair of them. So I felt that this kind of, and again, it happened organically, but this kind of economy with the way Cyril is just felt right. And then once I started doing it, it felt right for Paul. And so we pushed it a bit further and pushed it a bit further and so on.
We see a lot in the movie of what Reynolds gets from Cyril. What do you think Cyril gets from him? I mean, like what, because it's not an inequitable relationship, I don't think. I think it's very, there's a parity there that is important to their dynamic. So how would you kind of clarify or describe what she gets from this odd relationship?
Well, in a strange way, she gets everything from him. They are a couple who can sit at breakfast and say absolutely nothing and it's comfortable. She gets love from him, although it's unstated. She has security. He is her life. She's not married. She's never been married. She's never wanted to be married. It's all about serving him. And there's some backstory that we filled out, Daniel and I, for ourselves, and just to support what we felt was there in the script.
Is that's helpful to you to kind of build that thing, even if it's never stated?
Yeah, I mean, it isn't stated, but it is useful.
Yeah.
And in a way, although there's not much of an age difference between the two of them, she's like a mother and a sister and a friend and a business partner and a confidant. And, you know, he also has no qualms about getting her to deal with his lovers and muses when he's had enough of them. It is a strange relationship, but I think I love films where the relationships are strange.
Yeah.
And it's not conventional, and because nobody knows what goes on behind closed doors with a partnership.
And I think it's rare to see a brother-sister dynamic on
it
screen.
It is, yeah.
You know, we don't see a ton of that.
No.
So we see a lot of brothers kind of grappling with each other or sisters, whatever. But that is, you know, I have one sister and we don't have that kind of relationship. But like, there was something in there. I was like, yeah, this is interesting that it's kind of picking away at this.
Well, most siblings, generally speaking, you know, when they become adults, their lives become a little separate. separated, inevitably. But with these two, no, they've lived this kind of sort of almost hermetically sealed life. And they even go out for dinner together every evening. I mean, it's... And they go away to the country retreat at the weekends together.
Did that spill out into a relationship with Daniel Day-Lewis? Or like how had, you guys had not known each other prior to this? Or
no, we hadn't. I mean, we spent the 6-7 months prior to shooting just effortlessly becoming friends, really. And that, we met a few times, probably 2 or 3 times, because we don't live in the same place. We talked on the phone a lot. We'd text and... It was good. And although obviously Leslie and Daniel being friends is one thing, it felt important to have a bond together so that we could then take that and sort of reinterpret it and obviously put quite a few heavy slants on it for Cyril and Reynolds.
Yeah. I think our listeners are just going to freak out imagining a Leslie Manville, Daniel Day-Lewis text message conversation. And that's
yes.
That's pretty amazing.
Well, good.
Yeah. another thing that I love about this character and the way that you play it is that, you know, this is a very together, collected, she looks fabulous all the time kind of woman. Compare that to, you mentioned Mike Lee, you're beautiful in a whole different way character in another year where she's this kind of just sozzled sort of mess.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just two amazing, you know, sides of you, or I don't know, or maybe you're not either of those people, but like,
no.
Where would you plot yourself on that line? Like, where are you more Cyril? Are you more, you know?
I mean, first of all, I mean, that's all I'm interested in, doing different characters and doing characters that are not like me and doing characters that are different from the one I've just played, hopefully. Where would I fall between them? Well, you know, I have something of the order of Cyril's life. I mean, I'm tidy. I'm quite organized. I don't live a chaotic life, but I'm certainly not, you know, the lonely alcoholic drunk that Mary is, who is desperately exhausts her friends. At least I hope I don't exhaust my friends. Not in that way, anyway. But obviously, I understood completely the depths of Mary's despair. Somewhere along the line, you know, I was able to tap into that. But that's something to do with, you know, the way Mike works and the time you have and the thoroughness with which you... and the liberation that you have to create these characters.
Yeah, and with Mary and with Mike, you got to make what I think is... maybe my favorite closing shot of a film ever.
Isn't it wonderful?
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And did you know when filming that, like, this is, Mike told you this is how we close the film?
And in fact, it's interesting because when you make a film with Mike, you only really know about your stuff. It's imperative for the process that you don't know what other characters are up to, what other characters are saying about your character, because otherwise you couldn't do improvisations that would be trustworthy, because I would know that they know something, you know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah.
I kind of didn't know where the rest of the film was going. I didn't know what Jim Broadbent and Ruth Sheen were really up to in the scenes that I wasn't in. So I remember when it came to do that last scene, which is about 8 of us sitting around a table eating. And it was a complicated shot because there's a track all the way around the outside of the table. And the camera was going to track round and pick out everybody at the table as it went round and the various bits of conversation. And then I heard Mike talking to Dick Pope, his cinematographer, and I knew it was the last scene of the film. And he said, and then the camera will come round and then settle on Leslie. And I remember thinking, it's going to settle on me. Right. And in that moment, I thought, oh, maybe the emotional heart of this film or whatever is about Mary.
Oh, wow. So you really didn't even...
No.
Oh, wow.
I didn't...
It so is. I mean, she's...
Well, I know, but you don't... I didn't know that. And I, genuine shock, I thought, Christ, it's going to end on me. Well, I better do something good.
And you did. I mean, it's such a searching, sad, relatable, just, you know, kind of lost at this party and just sort of listening and trying to be cheery, but also
I know,
this that, interiority happening.
I know. I can't, sometimes I think about that character and it just makes me sad.
Do you think she's okay now?
Oh, Christ.
I mean, that's kind of a corny question.
I mean, the thing about that film and all, and Phantom Thread, I think, as well, is that And good films should leave you talking and wondering what's going to happen. You know, I don't like it when it's all tied up and it's all neat. And somebody said to me the other day, well, yeah, but what happens to Cyril at the end of Phantom Thread? I said, well, what did you want to happen? You wanted to skip off into the sunset with a lover? It's not going to happen. It's just more of the same. Or is that what you think? Or do you think that how will it be now that Alma is very much a part of the household and the balance of this sort of nearly 60-year relationship that she's had with her brother is going to have to be handled differently? You know, it's interesting.
But she has a respect for Alma, which I like.
She certainly, as time goes by, recognizes that Alma is a force to be reckoned with,
yeah,
and is actually challenging Reynolds in a way that she thinks is probably quite good for Reynolds.
Well, you also are a force to be reckoned with, and we're really happy that you came in to talk to us. Leslie Manville, thank you so much. This was great.
Thank you, Richard.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So next up is Richard's conversation with Jamie Bell, the star of Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool.
Well, I'm here sitting across the table from Jamie Bell. Welcome.
Thank you.
You and your wife were looking out the window and gazing out. Have you not been in this building before?
No, I've actually never been down to this part of town.
Oh, wow.
Ever.
Well, welcome. We're glad that we could be your first time.
That's very nice.
That's a good feeling. So you're kind of at the tail end of what has been a pretty long press tour junket. I don't know what the proper term is for Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool, which is finally coming out on the 29th. Is that right?
29th of December, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But I first saw it at Telluride, where it wasn't something, I'll be honest, that was on my radar going into the festival.
Yeah.
But then when I kind of found out who was in it and I said, okay, this is, you know, this could be something special. So I'm curious, like, how did you get involved with it? Like, when did it make an impression on you? Was it just reading the script or?
Yes. I mean, I was sent the script early last year and I knew nothing about Gloria Graham. I knew nothing about the subject of the film. All I knew was Annette Bening was in it and I read it kind of feverishly just because if it had her in it, I wanted to be a part of it. But I really thought it was a bizarre piece of fiction. I couldn't quite wrap my head around the story. It just felt so eccentric and so unexpected and so kind of unbelievable to a degree. And then when I met Barbara Broccoli, who produced the film, she told me that she knew Gloria Graham and Peter Turner, the subjects of the film, personally, and that this was a very personal story for her. She'd been trying to make it for 23 years or something. She handed me the memoir on which the film is based. I read that and it suddenly all kind of came to light for me a little bit more than the script was well written. There was nothing wrong with the script at all. Just reading something from his point of view, from his own experience, made it feel more, I don't know, more believable.
Yeah, because it has this kind of, so for people who don't know, it's about this younger man, aspiring actor in, what is it, like late 70s?
Late 70s,
yeah. In London, who meets a sort of faded old screen queen from Hollywood who's in England trying to kind of revive her career with theater. And they fall in love and it's kind of this eccentric thing. And it does seem a little bit stranger than fiction. But there's also something deeply cherished about the story. Like, this is this guy's life, this is his memories. Like, is that intimidating at all to sort of jump into that and kind of have to represent someone and also, you know, act in Barbara Broccoli's kind of passion project?
Well, certainly I think the care that he had for her, the affection that he had for her, Peter, I mean, you know, when you talk to him about it, and I certainly did talk to him many times and asked him many questions about his time with her and things that weren't necessarily in the book or things that were in the script that we wanted to, you know, maybe change. What you get from just talking to him is just how much he cared for her, still cares for her in some ways. I think the memoir was this kind of cathartic process to try and understand it all. It came to kind of such an abrupt end with not many answers and things like that. So that was really the challenge, the task that was set out before us was how do we make a movie with these two people, these kind of two very unexpected, odd couple scenario, make people go along on this journey and have them really believe that they're in love passionately, that they can, you know, even though there's clearly these all these divisions between them, their experiences, their life, generationally speaking, they're obviously different. How do we make people believe that they're equal in love and bring people along with us on that journey? That was always the tricky kind of challenge in it. And a lot of that was to do with me and Annette and how we get along. And
yeah, how did you guys kind of create that dynamic, that relationship? Because it feels very familiar in the movie. I mean, you guys seem to really know each other. How do you kind of create that on screen?
I mean, I guess you never really know if it's gonna happen. You know, I mean, when you walk into a movie, most of the time you haven't met the person you're going to be acting opposite, and you never know if you're going to get along, and you're spending so much intimate time with one another. And so I was really kind of unsure. So that first meeting, I was like really nervous because I was just hoping that we kind of hit it off immediately, and I think that would have been very unnatural. What we actually did is we sat down with the screenplay a lot and just went through it every single day. We had like 2 weeks of rehearsal and we didn't really get anything on its feet at all. We just read through the script a bunch of times. And I think through that, we both understood how passionate we both were about it and how seriously we were taking the roles. And we established a sense of trust, I think, and support. And we always had each other's backs. If she was uncomfortable doing something, I was uncomfortable doing something.
How far into the shooting process was the dance scene? Which is a wonderful, joyous scene.
It was fairly late on, I think. This film deals a lot with time and the passages of time, and the film will suddenly jump back 2 years and then, you know, flash forward.
Right.
2 years. I think we did the goodbye scene when, like, you know, she unfortunately has to go back to America and she shortly thereafter passes away. We shot the goodbye scene on like day two of the schedule. So it was just kind of so out of whack. But the dance scene was always a scene that I drew a circle around because I was like, if we can just get through the rest of this schedule, if we can just get through these bedroom scenes where she's, you know, kind of slowly deteriorating and it's very heavy, then at least we'll have summited. Yeah. But it was about halfway through, I would say.
I think that's, you know, when I sort of first noticed how much chemistry you guys had together. So I figured it had to have come not on the first day. Like, that was built.
No, saying I love you and goodbye was like right. The first day.
That's crazy. Another thing that's notable for me about this movie, is particularly as it pertains to you, is that you've been around a while. You know, you started acting and performing as a kid, big movie, Billy Elliot. And you've had an interesting kind of peripatetic. You've done different genres. You've done motion capture with Steven Spielberg. You've done, you know, World War II thrillers with Liev Schreiber. But we haven't really seen you do much in the kind of romantic lead department until this movie, which is good. I mean, it's exciting to see you kind of in this different mode. And I'm curious, like, how conscious are you in, like, when you're kind of picking projects, like, are you like, okay, I need my romantic movie, I need this? Are you that conscious of, like, genre? Or
I think not particularly. I mean, I think I'm always looking for something that's just a bit off center.
Yeah,
like, you know, so if it's a romantic lead, I need a but in there, like, I need a but it's surreal or it's abstract or there's something about it which isn't normal. I think otherwise, if it's too kind of, and I've had scripts where there's like romantic roles and they're just so kind of right down the middle that it kind of, it bothers me. I was like, get bored by them. Yeah. So I do need something extra. I need like that extra little additive that makes it something different. I think I always kind of admire work that is just slightly off, slightly abstract. But certainly I've had a plethora of opportunities to do different things all the time in period pieces. You know, all kinds of different period pieces. Roman Britain.
Yeah.
The famous bromance with Channing Tatum in this film called The Eagle. I don't know
it's
if you saw
movie.
That one. Thank you very
yeah.
much.
Yeah. Yeah. That's big with the gay community.
Yeah, yeah. Well, listen, no. Listen. I'm glad.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jane Eyre was a certain period and, as you mentioned, World War II stuff. So I guess I just have one of those faces that I'm very fortunate for. You can kind of, doesn't really matter. You can put him in anything.
Which is good. Is there anything you haven't done yet that you want to? Like any?
I
want to
dance again. I mean, I dance a little bit in this film. No, it's not the same thing, but I really do want to use my dance because it feels weird to have this thing just kind of lying dormant, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm probably not as good at it anymore.
Are you a singer?
I was asked that yesterday in the lobby of our hotel, wasn't it? Kate Mara's in the room. I'm just going to point that out. She's over there. She's sitting in the corner. Remember? He said, did you sing? I said, I'm a triple threat.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
No, the answer is no.
No, I don't sing. You don't. Okay, well, so... But I feel like there's a way, maybe you could do something like Christopher Walken in that video.
Spike Jones video.
Yeah, yeah, you know, something like that, where you're just showing off a skill. Well, I guess people know you have that skill, whereas with Walken, I feel like it was...
Yeah, but like, yeah, dancing in movies, when it's done well, it's amazing. You know what I mean? It looks so good.
I think that's something like that. About, that's such a thrill about that scene in Film Stars is just like, you guys were both good at it. And it's just like fun to watch. And it's not just people kind of flailing, you know, without meaning. There's actually like consideration and skill employed, which is exciting.
How are you at dancing?
No, terrible.
Oh, really?
Avoided it at all costs. Oh. Yeah, I think I went to a wedding. I went to a wedding last summer. I think I like reluctantly danced for like 2 seconds.
Did you? Just
like, all right. Well, it was a weird wedding. Like Mindy Kaling and Tina Fey were there.
Oh, weird.
It was a friend of mine who worked on 30 Rock and Mindy Project. Anyway, so it was just
well, those
like
people
kinda,
are very fun.
Yeah, but I was intimidated by them. So I was like, they can have the dance floor and I'll just sip my wine. And, okay. Yeah. So dancing, that would be exciting.
I would love to do something, some dancing.
What about
sure.
theater? Is that on
Yeah, I mean, it's always something that I've considered. I'm often kind of sent things, certainly out of London a lot more than Broadway. Like there's things to consider and stuff. And I've been very close in the last couple of years to doing something, but I have a kid, I have a wife, that kind of dedication to moving somewhere for that amount of time and just taking you out of other things kind of genuinely scares me. I'm always so in admiration of actors who'd go, they just do plays over and over and over again. I'm like, God, I don't know how you guys do that.
They're just kind of really deeply into it, I guess.
And but they're called real actors.
Yeah. Do you get a chance to see a lot, either theater or movies, TV? Like, what do you watch?
I try and see as many movies as I can. I don't see as many movies as I should. I'm very affected by movies. Like, I saw The Disaster Artist last night.
That's a good one.
And I knew nothing about The Room. I'd never seen The Room before. I had no idea who Tommy Wiseau was or anything. I certainly love all the actors in Disaster Artist and stuff. But movies really stay with me. They really do. I have these very strong relationships with them. I kind of obsess over them. I saw Gone Girl, I don't know, maybe 20 times.
Really?
And it was the only film I watched for about 3 months.
And what about that got you? Like, was it the acting? Was it the direction? Or just
I don't know. Because also the thing is that after I watched it about 5 times, I started to stop watching. As soon as you knew that she was alive, I stopped watching it.
Oh, so you just like that first half.
I love the first half.
Oh, that's
brilliant.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
But like things, I mean, Grand Budapest Hotel, I got obsessed. I have these very strange obsessions. I also love documentary more than like fiction films.
Have you gotten to see any documentaries this
no,
year?
No, but I do want to see Wormwood, which is the new Errol Morris.
Yeah, thing. Yeah, that's pretty engrossing. Yeah. They did a screening of the whole thing at Telluride where people were just kind of in the theater for 5 hours or 6 hours.
I saw the Jim and Andy thing, which I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I saw the Roger Stone one.
Have you
Netflix.
Seen Faces Places?
No, I haven't
Agnes
yet.
Varda,
no,
it's
no,
really good.
No, really?
Yeah, it's less of a, it's not literally about like facts. It's just kind of following these people around as they make art and talk about
it. I was at the Governor Awards and they were talking about her a lot and they were showing a lot of clips from that. It looked amazing.
Anything else on the scripted side that you've seen this year that has kind of stuck out?
I like Good Time very much. I don't know why other than it was, I went into it with zero expectations. I knew it was kind of cool and I was aware of those filmmakers and Robert is a friend of mine and I wanted to support him, but I was just blown. I was really blown away by it. It's so accomplished. I was behind it all the time. I was meaning the narrative constantly surprised me. And they're very simple kind of tricks, like a botched thing that goes wrong. And there's lots of kind of elements in it, which are very simple, but when they're executed well, it kind of keeps you on your toes. And it's very rare, I find, in movies where I don't know what's going on or what's going to happen or...
Well, right, because you read enough scripts, I would think.
So you just get used to these structures and stuff. So I was in there, you know, they were cradling me through that movie, like they were taking care of me. And I thought his performance was astonishing. Yeah. I really do. There was something immediate about it. It was very visceral and raw, and I'd never seen him do something like that before.
All you have to do is make, you know, tens of millions of dollars doing vampire movies, and then you can work with whatever directors you want for the rest of your life.
Yeah, but also, did you see Lost City of Z?
He's fantastic
he's
in that.
He's amazing
one
in
of the best movies of the year. Yeah. This is probably a kind of a trite question, but like when you're watching these things and there's a young performer like that in something like Good Time, how is there an envy factor? Are you like,
of
oh
course.
Shit, why? Yeah, I mean,
of course there is.
But you can still enjoy it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if it's someone that you like I love Rob, he's a friend of mine and I have nothing but support for him. And I've also been on record with me saying it's one of my favorite performances of the year. And like, I've told him many times, I sent him a text the other day and said, you were robbed, things like that. So, but yeah, of course, because everyone wants to be doing great work and working with the best people, you know? But I also study them. You know, if there's something that I really admire, I just watch it over and over and over again.
And you're producing as well. So you're kind of making stuff for yourself these days. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You have like something coming up. I don't know if you can talk about
no,
it.
No, I can't. So it's a movie called Teen Spirit. My best friend, Max Minghella, directed it. And Fred Berger, who did La La Land, is producing it. And I'm the executive producer on it. And it stars Elle Fanning. And it's about a girl who wants to sing.
Great. And
that's the very basic.
How do you like that role? I mean, is it like the producing aspect? I mean, is it did you have to kind of learn on the job, or did you just, you know, have the institutional knowledge because you'd been on so many film sets? Or,
well, I have a lot more sympathy for producers now.
Yeah,
actors really give them a hard time. Just just kind of witnessing that from the other side. Just really simple things of like, when are they getting into town? How close are they getting into town before shooting? Well, you know, 2 days before. Well, could we get like 5 days before? Like things like that. You
right.
Know? But no, I learned on the job. I followed Fred's lead a lot, and but to me, there's if you've made films. I mean, I've been making films for half my life. There is the kind of instinctual element of this is how things should be done, and
right. And I find that like with things like that, you know, if someone asks me a question, not about writing particular, but like about how some other aspect of the media world works. After 10 years in it, I'm like, oh, actually, I kind of do know the answer to that, even though I don't think of myself as that.
Right, because we're in post right now, so it's like a kind of editorial process. And while I know I've used editing equipment before, I certainly don't really know the ins and outs of like the subtleties of filmmaking, pre-lapping sound, or what those little techniques that you know so well if you've been doing it forever. So it's all a learning curve. I think for me and for Max, you know.
And something you'd like to do again.
Totally. I mean, yeah. I'd work with Max from now till forever. I think he's a great filmmaker. His vision for this is very specific, and the movie looks beautiful. We had this girl called Autumn Gerald. She was the DP on this movie. She shot Palo Alto and a bunch of other things. She's got an amazing eye. This movie looks so beautiful. And Elle, I think, will surprise people. She sings covers of these songs. So we've recorded them with Marius De Vries, who is the music supervisor. I think her voice is going to blow people away.
And this is something to look forward to next year?
Next year, we're kind of considering, you know, which route to go with it.
Like festivals
exactly,
or whatever.
Exactly,
yeah.
So that's all kind of...
Music, that feels like South by Southwest or something.
Maybe something like that.
We are ostensibly an award season podcast. Is that something you pay attention to at all?
Like, how can you not?
Yeah. It's like an aspirin. Like, are you like, oh, that'll be me someday? Or are you more just kind of watching like...
No, it's all business.
Yeah.
It's everything's business. I mean, I pay attention to, I mean, things that I really shouldn't. Numbers, you know, opening week, theater counts. How wide is it going?
So you're reading Box Office Mojo.
All the time, constantly, yeah. But it's also easily obtained now, which I love.
Yeah.
You know.
It's right there.
Me and Max often go backs and forwards. Can you believe like the second week drop off of blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny because I see you guys kind of lurking on Twitter. Right. Yeah, you know, yeah, you don't say a lot, but you're there.
No, we're always
you're
watching.
Reading. Yeah. All right. Well, that's good to know. Take that with you as we go into the holiday season. Jamie Bell is watching you. And you can watch Jamie Bell December 29th in Film Stars Don't Die in Liverpool. Jamie, thank you so much.
It's such a pleasure. It is an honor, in fact.
Oh, likewise.
Thank you.
And to you, Kate.
Exactly. Thanks, Katie.
That does it for this week's Little Gold Men. Happy New Year. We will see you in 2018. In the meantime, you can find our work at vanityfair.com, and we're all on Twitter at Little Gold Men. This episode was edited and produced by Danielle Roth, and thanks to Andy Bowers at Panoply.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.